Hello, and welcome to the Skeleton Factory Podcast.
Season 2, Episode 1.
My name is Adam. I'm the host of Skeleton Factory. And I really wanted to have a really big opening show for Season 2. A big, exciting show with thrills and chills. And then I got home.
Oh.
After sitting in traffic. Because the solar eclipse is going to take place. And there's like a million people in and around the Austin, Texas area. See a fucking solar eclipse, and it's probably gonna be overcast and no one's gonna see it, and the companies that spent millions and billions of dollars printing up millions and billions of eclipse glasses that look like 3D glasses used specifically to stare at the sun will go to waste. So all those people, we're clogging up the 183 and the 35 and other Texas freeways you've never heard of. Ooh. I was trying to remember why I even got on that. I came home and I felt antsy. So I made a martini. Made a nice martini, and I made a big one. So, I didn't put it into a martini glass. We had a really nice pair here at the Skeleton Factory Studios. We had recently purchased two beautiful etched glass martini glasses. And during an argument one night, I accidentally slapped one off of the counter and it exploded on the floor. So now we only have one. So I was hanging out with my interior designer, and we were both very stressed from just trying to traverse this fresh corpse of a city that Austin is. It's just slowly being picked apart right now. The flies are picking at it. The lions haven't quite got to the carcass yet, but it's getting there. So we both we get in and they're like, "Hey, you want a martini?" Like, "Yeah, that sounds good." So I make my interior designer a martini, and then I just make mine in like a bucket glass, and I made mine like twice as big. So instead of being caffeinated and well rested, I'm exhausted, I'm legally drunk. And I figured now is as good a time as any to start Season 2, Episode 1 of Skeleton Factory, the greatest cult film podcast in the state of Texas. People's fascination with mainstream movies is so gross to me. It's like everything is shit and everyone obsesses about it. Okay, here, I want to read you something. Okay. This is a quote from Variety magazine. It's just online now. I don't even know if Variety is even a physical paper magazine anymore. Quote, though plot details are being kept under wraps, Variety exclusively revealed in March that the film will mostly be a jukebox musical, integrating at least 15 reinterpretations of well-known songs. One is said to be That's Entertainment from the 1953 musical The Bandwagon, made famous by Judy Garland. However, one or two original songs may find their way onto the soundtrack. End of quote. What is that a description of? That would be Joker Part 2, Revenge of the Joker. No, that's not what it's called. It's called Joker Joie de Vie or Joker Jolie Adieu. That's where I knew they were going to fail, when you have a French title. Don't have the French language in the title of your movie for Americans to try to read. Okay, we're not good with other languages at all. We don't like other languages. Okay, when Americans go to other countries and nobody speaks English or speaks poor English, we wonder, what is wrong with all these foreigners? That's the way Americans think. What movie is this? This movie that's said to have 15 reinterpretations of well-known songs and one or two original songs that are being kept under wraps, and Variety exclusively revealed in March. Just the cunty nature of how Variety and websites like Variety write their shit is so nauseating and phony. Okay, well, it's like, so they're describing the new Joker movie, and who, like, this movie's going to completely flop. It is. First of all, French title. No one asked for a French title. Second of all, it's a sequel to, like, the first Joker movie was, it's like a lazy person's, it's like a lazy person who fancies themselves like a psychiatrist, like, thinks, like, when they watch the Joker, they can diagnose what's going on, but they do it in like a clinical way. In a way they have no training in at all. It's one of those movies. A movie that's technically done well, and it's shot very nicely, and the acting is good. Okay, and you watch it, and I don't know, it's just the if you're gonna have sort of the villain wins at the end misery porn, it's too bombastic, you know, it's too glorious of an ending, you know, it's like, if you want to know if Joker 2 is going to be successful, look at Joker 1, and not in the sense of, well, Joker 1 was very successful, Adam, so therefore Joker 2 must be successful. It's like, no, the fact, like, how it was successful, like, you can't repeat that. You can't, you know, a lot of people made comparisons from Joker to Taxi Driver. You can't have Taxi Driver 2, okay? Like, the time it took to build the tone of Taxi Driver Okay. It's making a sequel, you know, 18 months after the original Taxi Driver comes out, cheapens the original and cheapens the sequel at the same time. It's like The Exorcist. They made The Exorcist 2, and it was an inferior film in The Exorcist franchise. So, also, and I've talked about this on other shows, I just don't remember which ones. Todd Phillips, director of Joker 2, The Search for Bruce Wayne's Gold, or whatever they want to call the movie. He was the guy who directed The Hangover, which I saw about 10 minutes of The Hangover. Somewhere in the middle, or maybe it was the beginning, I don't know. I watched about 10 minutes of The Hangover, and then I just didn't feel like watching it anymore. But the first Hangover made a lot of money, made all the guys that were in that movie more famous. And then if you go back, okay, you jump forward rather to Hangover 2, it was reviewed a lot more harshly. It wasn't as well received. And then by the time you get to 3, it's like watching Superman 4. Okay? Like the magic is gone. Okay? You're beating a dead horse to death with a dead horse. So I don't think Lady Gaga can rescue Joker 2. And no one wants to see another musical. Okay, musicals were for a very niche crowd. Also, no, it's like, do you want to listen to 2+ hours potentially of 15 reinterpretations of well-known songs? No, you don't. That's entertainment from Bandwagon. Have you seen Bandwagon? No one's seen that movie. You know, nothing against Bandwagon. You know, I actually don't mind old musicals, but you know, that shit's corny. It works for back in the day. It works for Mary Poppins or The Music Man. But I don't think it works in modern day. It's for a very small sliver of the audience. And I'm putting on my fortune teller turban and rubbing my crystal ball, and I'm just predicting right now that Joker 2 is going to flop. Just like I predicted that Napoleon would flop. It would be in and out of theaters. No one would give a shit. Anyways. So how are you liking season 2, episode 1 of Skeleton Factory, a cult film podcast about movies? One thing I want to talk about that was I found kind of strange in it. It was on Easter. I went to brunch at a very fancy hotel here in Austin. And afterwards, I was taking a walk with the group of people I was with. And we stopped off at this bar. And there was like a shift change. It's during the day. The place wasn't even really that busy, but it was a pretty good bar. But there was a shift change while we were sitting there. And the bartender that came in, you know, seemed like a I almost said he seems like a nice guy, but he didn't. He's actually, yeah, I don't know if that's true, actually. Because when the shift change happened, he just didn't have the vibe of a bartender that I like. You know what I mean? He didn't make his presence known. You know, he wasn't touching base with people. You know, you guys need another drink? How are we all doing over here? Like none of that. None of that bartender charm that I really like. But it took me a minute. He was talking to the other bartender who was there when we got there, right? And they were in the middle of the shift change. And I can hear them talking. I wasn't really paying attention. But I heard the first bartender say to, you know, the closing bartender, let's call him. He was basically like, so how do you shake your drinks? And I was like, I'm like, what an odd question for a bartender to ask another bartender. You know, it seems like even an experienced bartender, like that seems like something you would ask an amateur bartender or something. So I kind of direct my attention to their conversation. And the guy's basically like, oh, I basically have to do it, you know, two-handed, you know. And the guy's like, yeah, that makes sense. And the guy looks over to where we are and he's like, can I get you guys anything else? And he kind of like sticks his hand out a little bit. He's like, can I get you guys anything else? And I notice that his hand is like a hook, not like a prosthesis metal hook. It was like his hand, I think, was just deformed. I think he was born with like a little stubby fist with like, it looked like he had a partial index finger and half a thumb. And then on the other hand, it was kind of a similar situation. It was like a little nub fist. And I think there was like a part of a thumb and maybe like part of a pinky. And as soon as I noticed it, I mean like a fraction of a second, like I just noticed it. I look up and the guy's noticed that I looked at his hands. And then the conversation from earlier about like, the guy's like, how do you shake a shaker? He's like, oh, I have to use both hands. And I was like, oh, that's gnarly. I actually try to ask people like if they have like a missing foot or leg or hand or arm or eyeball. I'm like, what happened to your eyeball? Or what happened to your leg? They don't get offended. A lot of those people, they really don't mind, actually. And it's not like the guy fucked up our orders or anything. But I was like, oh, look at that guy just working in a very busy, kind of high-end bar where every drink has all kinds of little fucking doodads and little tricks and things that have manipulations that have to take place. I was like, oh, this guy. I didn't really think anything of it. And then I want to say, maybe 48 hours later, I go to the grocery store. Go to H-E-B. That is the grocery store chain here in Texas. H-E-B. And it's basically a Safeway. It's a Ralph's kind of store, right? But better, actually. It's better than Safeway. It's better than Ralph's. Better than Vaughn's. So I'm walking in and I go to the area to grab like a hand basket because I don't need a whole cart. I'm not getting too much shit. And I go and I grab a handbasket, and I see this girl at the self-checkout. She's walking up to the self-checkout, and she's like a young woman. You know, she's probably like 22 or something, and she's wearing like pajama pants and like a tank top, and she has like huge tits. You know, very normal looking girl. And then I notice that both of her hands are like weird, nubby fist finger hands, like the bartender guy. I was like, what the fuck? That was just weird to me. I was just, like, they look like, I almost thought that is it, that they were related, perhaps, because like their hands were so similar. But like, how often do you see, like, when I lived in San Francisco, I actually saw quite a few just amputees. You know what I mean? Like people who just been shooting up between their toes for so long, they just had their fucking foot amputated and, you know, shit like that. Or, you know, you go to a coffee shop and there's some, you know, financial district guy, you know, who's heading to the office or something, and he just has, you know, his arms missing from like the elbow down, you know what I mean? But never like deformed hands or people with deformities of any kind. You don't see that often. To see two people with the identical deformity in like a 48-hour period, that weirded me out. It's interesting. Not that I think it's, I don't think it's weird in the sense that it's actually, I think it's the appropriate amount of weird. You know, if you saw somebody with like two deformed hands, you would be naturally weirded out in a natural reaction type of way. You know, but seeing two people like that in a 48-hour period, I was like, and the girl with the big tits, she had like a boyfriend. So, I'm like, how does that work? Sure, walked up behind her while she was scanning, bagging her groceries, and I'd be like, hey, when you're with your boyfriend, do you have to use both hands? Anyways, let's get into the show, shall we? Also, I should probably mention that I have some stuff up on Patreon. Okay, I'm making a nice push towards video content on Patreon. So that's at patreon.com/skeletonfactory, and that's the best place to support the show and fund all my HEB runs and buy me vodka and incense sticks and hardcover original first editions of Blade Runner 2, The Edge of Human, written by K.W. Jeter. Something I just got in the mail recently. I was unaware that there was a sequel to Blade Runner, but in book form, until recently, so I just bought that. So that's be the next book I'm reading. My springtime lunar eclipse book for the season. But yeah, go over to patreon.com/skeletonfactory and become a member today. And if you don't want to be a member, just stop being a member after about 3 to 18 months. Okay, and if you'd like to get a hold of me, if you'd like to comment on the show, ask me some questions, movie suggestions, if you have questions about life that you need me to help answer for you, go over to Instagram at skeleton_factory. That's where I'm primarily at. It's on Instagram. I'm also on X. Okay. Formerly known as Twitter. At SF Podcast ATX. And I'm not on X too much. It's just too gnarly for me there. It's just gross. And I feel like I need to fucking take a shower after I go to Twitter. But yeah, those are all the places that I am at besides here. On wherever you happen to be listening to this, whether if it's on Spotify or Apple Podcasts or whatever. Well, let's see. Well, there's two movies specifically I wanted to chat with you about. Okay. The first is a comedy, all right, from 1987, and it's called Amazon Women on the Moon. Now, this film has a handful of directors, okay? Big directors of the time. We have Joe Dante, we have Carl Gottlieb, Peter Horton, John Landis, and Robert K. Weiss. So, directors that have comedic backgrounds, comedic and drama backgrounds. And what is this movie? This movie is, it's basically a ton of comedic skits smushed into one movie. Okay. A la Kentucky Fried Movie, but it's arguably better than Kentucky Fried Movie, you know, and it's, I find this movie funnier than most comedies, TV shows, movies, or otherwise. I think it's funnier than most comedic podcasts. I find most comedic podcasts to be superficially interesting and not very funny and very try hard, and I don't like it. I don't like watching podcasters drinking liquid death. Why are you drinking liquid death? Look at the logo for liquid death. It looks like it's like a skull made of sperm. That's what the logo looks like. And then you drink that. Drinking water from a can. I don't know who normalized that. Like, the only water from a can you should be drinking is carbonated water. And that's it. That's the only type of water you should be drinking from a can. And it shouldn't be liquid death. Liquid death is, it's the shake weight of water. It's the fidget spinner of water. It's the Beanie Babies of water. Amazon Women on the Moon. It's very funny. It's funnier than, Poor Things. Remember Poor Things? Oh my God, Yorgos Lanthimos film. Yorgos Lanthimos, by the way, he's on the decline. Okay, after I saw Poor Things, I was like, I think Yorgos Lanthimos is at, I don't know how old Yorgos Lanthimos is, but I would imagine he's rather old at this point. He's past his peak, and most directors are like athletes. You age out at some point. Okay, you just, whether it's maturity, getting old, whatever, at some point you lose your edge and you're just not the director you used to be. That's most directors. And I fear Yorgos Lanthimos is heading there. Poor Things was a a middle of the road movie for me. It was a very average film. I've never had like a star rating system or at the movies. Like, I don't rate it by buckets of popcorn or a thumbs up, thumbs down. I just rather recommend something or I don't recommend something. That's basically my grading criteria. But if I had to give Poor Things a score based, let's say, I don't know, out of 5 stars, what would I give Poor Things? Well, it can't be 5. Very few films are 5. Can't be 4. You know, very few films are 4. It's definitely not a 3. Okay, a 3 is... What's a 3? A 3 is like... I don't know. Gremlins. I know people love Gremlins and... You know, Gremlins is a classic, and you know, and everything. But you know, if I had a choice between watching Gremlins 1 or 2, I'd probably say that 2 is closer to a 4 than 1 is. You know, but yeah, so Poor Things would probably be a 2.5 stars out of 5, maybe a 2. I'm gonna say 2. A nice round 2 stars out of a possible 5 for Poor Things. And I didn't think a lot of the... I don't think a single joke in Poor Things landed for me. You know, not that like every joke attempt made my eyes roll or anything like that. It was more of just like when the joke came, like I didn't laugh. And I think people... forget that laughing is like a reflex. You know, it almost happens involuntarily. And I feel like humor and comedy is now not that. That things are funny based on some sort of like delayed analytical, like taking the temperature of the room. Like, is it okay that this is funny to everyone here in the room before I laugh? As opposed to someone says something funny and you laugh. That's what Poor Things was to me. Amazon Women on the Moon is better than Poor Things. It's better than Wonka. I am not a Timothy Chalamet fan. Okay, he's in too much stuff, and let me see. I don't think he's like someone who's like just doesn't serve a. He's not like John Bernthal. Like John Bernthal doesn't serve a purpose being in anything. But Timothy Chalamet, like he was in that film Bones and All, and I thought. That was a decent movie. I, from what I remember, I don't even remember if I liked that movie. I remember not hating that movie. I remember thinking like, oh, what an interesting premise for a movie. I thought he was fine in that. But I'm not going to watch Wonka. Okay? There's just... That's a no from me. Like, Wonka's not funny. It's not charming. And a musical. It's like... No one's checking for musicals. Now you want to make a remake of a beloved film and it's a musical. It's like, how many ways are you going to shoot yourself in the foot with a fucking machine gun? I'm not going to watch Ricky Stenicki. No one should be watching films starring John Cena. Okay. John Cena. I don't want to see wrestlers in movies. Okay. I don't watch movies with The Rock. I only watch movies with Dave Bautista, ironically, to make fun of them, like Knock at the Cabin or Dune 2. I'm not a fan of Dune 2, by the way. I'm sorry. I know there's a lot of Dune fans out there. But most Dune fans are people who are just like, just dick writers, you know, like most things. Like, oh, I love Dune. No, you don't. No, you don't. Dune 2, like, you know that Empire Strikes Back is better. You know it is. You know, it's like here's the sad thing about, I saw Dune 2 in theaters. Dune 2 suffers from a badly casted, it's a badly casted film. Okay? That most of the people in the film, particularly Timothy Chalamet, who, I don't know, it's kind of hard for me to, like, he wasn't terrible. You know, I know he had to kind of, at least on paper, carry the movie, but he, once you see the movie, he wasn't carrying the movie at all. Zendaya, or like Zen diagram, a diagram that shows me drowning people in fucking dirty toilets, and then the other diagram shows how close Zendaya is to my current location. Okay, people need to stop trying to make Zendaya a thing. It's not gonna happen. Okay, she's not a good actress. She's not interesting. You know, she's not that hot. You know what I mean? And there, people are just trying to make her something she's not. You know what they're trying? You know what she is? I'll tell you what she is. Actress Michelle Rodriguez is too fucking old to be the brooding 20-year-old Mexican Latina Latinx tough girl. She's too old now. She's, you know, probably in her late 40s at this point. Too old. So they're like, we need a pretty girl who just won't ever smile ever. So that's who Zendaya is now. They think that, like, she's going to be the next Michelle Rodriguez. Like, when they reboot the Fast and the Furious movies, you know, in a couple of years, like, she'll probably be in it. She'll be the Michelle Rodriguez character. But yeah, John Cena. Let me get back to John Cena. I prefer when John Cena's not acting. I also prefer when he's not wrestling. So there you go. But Amazon Women on the Moon, I would say it has a, just visually, even if you just watch it with the sound off, it has a level of craftsmanship that you just don't see in movies, both in acting, sets, tone. You know, because the movie is comprised of skits. So you only have a very small window for whatever director is directing that particular segment. Very small window for them to kind of just establish all the characters, establish the environment, and make it memorable. You know, that takes talent. So I would say the level of craftsmanship in Amazon Women on the Moon is more akin to something like American Fiction. If you haven't seen American Fiction, I'd recommend it. It's probably the first movie in the past couple of years that I would say, if you want to watch a movie with your family, like, watch American Fiction. And by family, I mean, not, don't watch with your children or something. But if you're an adult and your parents are still alive, or maybe even your grandparents, you know, and you just want to, like, sit around and watch a movie, like an adult film, like, where people in the movie are acting like fucking adults, you know, like, who are, the actors are portraying actual people who act like human beings. American Fiction is great for that. Like, it was, and it's funny. There's like lots of tragedy in American Fiction, but but all the jokes are there, and they don't seem particularly forced or anything like that. And everyone in the movie, not everyone in the movie, I find to be like the best actors ever, but it was casted well. Everyone in the movie made sense. And when everyone was talking to other people, it made sense. Okay. You had good actors having interactions with other good actors, something that Dune 2 didn't have. And if you go back and watch Dune 2, if you're skeptical of my analysis of Dune Part 2, there are most scenes in Dune 2 comprise of the following. A bad actor, somebody who's stiff, I don't know, does it, you know, very wooden, not interesting actor. And then they will be usually talking to somebody who's a superior actor. And the superior actor in the scene is sort of carrying the scene. Even if the bad actor in that scene is sort of the focal point, the better actor kind of props them up and makes them look like they're not as bad of an actor. But it didn't work in Dune. It just highlighted how shittier of an actor they were compared to the other ones. Like, for instance, Dave Bautista, who looked fucking fat. Holy shit, he looked really fat. He was his uncle in Dune, is that fat guy who was bathing in, you know, fucking balsamic vinegar and olive oil. He's one of the Skarsgårds. I'm blanking on that dude's name, but he's a really good actor. He's in a ton of shit, you know, and he's Dave Bautista's uncle, you know. So Dave Bautista comes in and does his fucking out of breath sleep apnea fucking lines. The Atreides are breaching the spice mines of the. I'm like, we're not gonna do a second take, Dave. Let's do a second take, Dave. Let's do it again. Let's run that back. Let's go back to one. That was terrible. Okay, and then his uncle would come out of the fucking balsamic vinegar with the fucking lights on his back and wearing a fat suit. And yes, he would be acting. He would be saying the lines with the bravado and, you know, acting. Let's see. What's homeboy's name? Timothy Chalamet, his mom in the movie. Every scene that she's in, she's carrying him. She's probably the only person in the whole movie that had a real character arc. You know, somebody who started one way in the beginning of the movie and then along the way goes through all these twists and turns and has to make all these sacrifices and hard choices and comes out the other side like a different person. You know, Timothy Chalamet, he's not really that much different by the end of Dune 2, but craftsmanship, that's my point. Okay. And you know what's funny? Here's what's funny in a movie. Tragedy. Tragedy is funny. Movies like The Piano Teacher. Go watch The Piano Teacher. It's very funny, even though it's very awkward. There's very odd sexual situations. There's, you know, moments that are very violent. But it's also very funny. Okay, you have to have a balance. It can't just be 100% pedal to the metal, violence and torture for two straight hours. I mean, it could be that, but it's usually balanced better if there's little moments of levity. Okay, or what about Into the Wild? Did you watch Into the Wild? I've been saying this for years. Nobody seems to agree with me. Rather, out of fear or out of ignorance. Okay? Into the Wild is one of the best non-intentional comedies ever made. And I think where everyone's kind of asses tighten up is they're like, well, this is a true story. This was like a real guy, and he went into the wild, and he died out in the woods. I'm just like, how did he die? Did he get eaten by a bear? Did he get bitten in the face by a rattlesnake? Did he fall off a cliff trying to free solo? No. He fucking ate some, like, bad mushrooms because he didn't know how to read his mushroom identification book denoting poisonous mushrooms. And then he dies, and we're supposed to, like, feel bad. And he's, like, this anti-capitalist, hippie dork. But that movie's unintentionally very funny. What about Precious? Remember the movie Precious? I believe Mariah Carey won an Academy Award for Precious. Don't quote me on that. But Precious is very funny. I mean, it's very sad. And it's very upsetting. And there's a social commentary in the film. And there's really good performances, you know. But it's funny. It's all the other things, too. They can be both. But Amazon Women on the Moon. It has a star-studded cast, okay? Giant cast. So we have, let's see, here's some familiar names. You have David Alan Greer, Michelle Pfeiffer, Carrie Fisher, Sybil Danning, Ed Begley Jr., B.B. King, Russ Meyer, and a personal favorite of mine, Howard Hessman, amongst others. And hold on, I wanted to read. Oh, why does it have to be way over here? Okay. I like books about movies, you know. And here is. I should have bookmarked it before I started recording. I'll find it. Oh my God, there's. Okay. Am I close? There it is. There's a book that I like to reference called Video Spine Grinder: The Movies Most Critics Won't Talk About. Written by a guy named Clive Davies. And it was put out by a company called Head Press. And it's basically a reference guide for cult movies, essentially. You know? And it's a very thick book. And all the reviews in them are very short and sweet, and they give you just kind of basic information. Let me see. Here's the description of Amazon Women on the Moon from Video Spine Grinder. Let's see. 1985. I don't know if that's right. Let's see. Here's a sequel to the overrated, unfunny Kentucky Fried movie. It's funnier than its precursor, despite having many lame segments, but wasn't released for 2 years. My favorite part was Ed Begley Jr. as the Invisible Man. Henry Silver presents Bullshit or Not, with Sybil Danning, William Marshall, Blackula, Russ Meyer, Arsenio Hall, Monique Gabriel, Lou Jacoby, Michelle Pfeiffer, the great Dick Miller, Jenny Aggutter, Griffin Dunn, Steve Forrest, Lana Clarkson, Steve Guttenberg, Rosanna Arquette, Kelly Preston, Angel Tompkins, Corrine Wall, Ralph Bellamy, Howard Hessman, Andrew Dice Clay, Joey Travolta, Keenan Ivory Wayans, B.B. King, Forrest J. Ackerman, Steve Allen, Henry Youngman, or I'm sorry, that's actually a typo. It's actually Henny Youngman, the old as fuck comedian. The Take My Wife, Please, that guy. That's Henny Youngman. But in the book, it says Henry Youngman. Typo. Jackie Vernon, Rip Taylor, Slappy White, Charles Kalas, Carrie Fisher, Mike Mazursky, Paul Bartel. Oh, yes, Paul Bartel is in the film. Fantastic. From Eating Raoul and director of Death Race 2000. Phil Hartman, Joe Pantoliano, William Bryant, Phil Proctor, Bryan Cranston, Robert Picardo, Mark McClure, Herb Vigran, Huey Lewis, Robert Loggia, and footage of Bela Lugosi. Theatrical, video, and TV versions differ, so the cast may change a little from version to version. Enough laughs for a drunken good time. Thank you very much, Clive Davies, Video Spine Grinder. The movies most critics won't write about. I love that. Just 99% of their review is just naming the cast and mentioning how much they don't like Kentucky Fried Movie. I thought that was funny. So let's blow through all 21 skits of this film, shall we? But like many anthology movies, and I think this is considered an anthology movie or an anthology type movie, there tends to be a wraparound story for movies like this. It's like Creepshow, for instance. You know, there's like the story with the kid, and you know, he reads Creepshow, and his dad doesn't want him reading comics because they're garbage. And was it part two? It's one of the creep shows where there's a bully and the bully's picking on the kid, and the kid orders like human eating Venus flytraps from the back of a comic book. And then one day the bully comes to pick on the main kid, and then the Venus flytraps eats the bully. You know, that's the wraparound story of Creep Show. So in this movie, the movie sort of presented as if we are flipping through channels or switching channels on a TV, but we keep going back to a presentation of a 1950s style sci-fi movie called Amazon Women on the Moon. It's a sort of boy and his dog type 50s movie mixed with like movies like She or something like that. And it's just something that the movie will keep, you know, jumping back to from time to time. And I mean, Amazon Women on the Moon is kind of like, it's like if Luke Skywalker was going to Dagobah, and when he got there, Yoda was trying to fuck him. You know, if Yoda was like, you must stay here on Dagobah, complete your training, but first, suck my dick. Okay, that's kind of what the movie is like. But here's some of my favorite skits from the movie. Okay, there was the first. Well, the first one was called Mondo Kondo. It was directed by John Landis, starring Arsenio Hall as a accident-prone fella. You know, he comes home after a long day, and we get several minutes of just sort of comedic pratfalls going on in his apartment, his very, very 80s apartment. And a lot of clumsy people back in the day. That was just a staple in 80s comedy. They were always like the clumsy person, you know, like I'm. Arsenio Hall's character was like, imagine a black version of Cadet Carl Sweetchuck from the Police Academy movies. He was kind of like that. But he basically gets home, you know, he tries to open a beer in the kitchen, and the beer blows up and sprays in his face. He tries to eat a sandwich out of the fridge, and the sandwich is bad somehow, so he throws it in the garbage disposal. And he goes to turn on the garbage disposal, but his tie gets stuck in the garbage disposal and almost sucks him in. Then he tries to go watch a video, and he gets a video cassette of Mandingo, puts in the VCR, but it gets stuck. And when he goes to look, the tape springs out, hits him in the face, so on and so forth. I thought it was great. You know, it was corny at the time. I mean, it's even corny now, but I mean, the comedy is just so intentional, and for what it is, it's very well done. Okay, it's not trying to be clever, you know. And I think honesty is a very important part of a good joke. The second skit I really liked was one called Pet House Pet. It was directed by Carl Gottlieb. And this is probably by far the best skit of all, simply because of the full frontal nudity, courtesy of professional naked person Monique Gabriel. And she's like a true B-movie queen, okay? She's appeared in, like, Return to Swamp Thing and Bachelor Party and the Emmanuel movies. She was in Emmanuel 5. And it's basically, like, I'm a penthouse pet. And it's her, like, on a photo shoot, naked, getting pictures taken of her. And then she's like, but I'm also a normal girl. I like to go to the art gallery. And it's her at the art gallery, but she's still naked. And she's like, and religion is very important to me, and I always go to church every Sunday. And the camera pans across people at church, and she's sitting there, and she's wearing a little church hat, but she's, other than that, she's just completely naked. Basically, the whole joke of that skit is she's naked the whole time. When this movie came out, you may remember Siskel and Ebert. They didn't like this film at all. But that's fine, because I had both of them killed. So now we're rid of their subpar film and analysis, okay? Siskel and Ebert are like Coolio getting mad at Weird Al for covering Gangster's Paradise, in that there's a skit in this movie called Critic's Corner, directed by Joe Dante. It's a very light parody poking fun at Siskel and Ebert. And they decided to completely snowflake out and using their larger platform to pretend that they didn't completely love this movie. And they trashed this movie. And trash the idea that anyone would mock them. So, you know, for as good as Siskel and Ebert's the show was, those guys were kind of shitheads at the same time. And here's an example of it. Also, they didn't like The Thing. Imagine that. Imagine not absolutely loving The Thing. So there's also a skit called Video Pirates, which I got a kick out of. And Video Pirates is about these pirates, like total swashbuckling pirates on a pirate ship whose their particular booty that they like to go after, their treasure is they will is physical media. It's videos and laser discs, and they basically pillage videos and laser discs from battling other pirate ships. Okay, so we get a scene where they're like fighting another pirate ship and they're shooting cannons at each other, and they end up taking over, you know, the other pirate ship, and they kill everybody. And the main the pirate captain is played by William Marshall, who we all know as the second and probably the best king of cartoons from Pee-wee's Playhouse. And of course, he's Blackula. So it's always great to see William Marshall. Very classy gentleman. You know, William Marshall makes Morgan Freeman look like George Floyd. Okay. I can't impress upon you how silky smooth William Marshall was. He will be missed. There's a post-credit skit called Reckless Youth, starring Paul Bartel and Carrie Fisher. I mean, just that skit alone, it's shot in black and white, but it has more cinematic entertainment and charm than most of the dreck passing itself as comedy nowadays. Okay, it's, you know, just condensed into a very short clip. But in general, this movie is, it's not so much a comedy as it is a charming, lighthearted anthology movie. Okay, so imagine if the show Tales from the Crypt was more gags and silliness than violence and horror, but at the same time it's still adult oriented. So I mean, I really like this movie. I mean, Amazon, a lot of people don't know about this movie, and it's a total cult film, you know, even though it was made by very famous directors starring a bunch of famous people, and it's like everyone forgot about it. So Amazon Women on the Moon came out on September 18th of 1987. Okay, it was released the same week as Fatal Attraction, Hellraiser, and The Princess Bride. So that's probably why you never heard of it. And that's, it was, and that's how some cult films come into being. Okay? They're interesting movies that get overshadowed or outmarketed by bigger movies that may or may not be as good, but over time they get discovered by audiences, and as time goes by, as it gets discovered, like a newfound love and appreciation and fondness for the movie really solidifies. And after the Alec Baldwin film Rust, if you're not familiar, that's the movie where Alec Baldwin shot and killed a woman named Helena Hutchins, and wounded director Joel Souza. Okay, Rust is set to hit theaters this year, and Baldwin is lucky that New Mexico, where this film was shot and where he shot Miss Hutchins, removed the death penalty as a punishment for murder. But that movie's still coming out. Why do I bring up Alec Baldwin? Well, one of the directors, John Landis, prior to making Amazon Women on the Moon in 1982, just a few years prior, was directing what became the Twilight Zone movie, where tragically actors Vic Morrow and two child actors, one named Renee Chenier and Micah Chinle, died in a freak accident involving the spinning blades of a helicopter. So, I mean, if you want to see a video of that, it exists on the internet. But that was an accident. You know, it wasn't like John Landis, like, got behind this into the cockpit of a helicopter and just pointed the blades at three innocent people. Okay. So it's just having that sort of that reputation on John Landis going into this movie probably stifled this movie being bigger, probably, I'm guessing. But the particular copy I have is a from a company called Cinema Cult, and it's a Blu-ray copy, and it looks fantastic, and it's got some decent special features. But yeah, the release itself is really good. If you can find, if you have a multi region Blu-ray player, I'd recommend picking it up. Okay. So that's it for me with Amazon Women on the Moon. I do recommend it. Go check it out. Well, before I get to the final film of this episode, I'd like to say that if you're ever in the Austin area, please come on down to a place called Tweety's Bar on the first and third Tuesday of every month. I host a horror and cult film trivia night for at least the foreseeable future. It's a great time. It's a great bar. And really fun people come out. I give out prizes. I tend to do two separate games. One at 7 and one around 8:15 or so. It's kind of your standard trivia format, but it's primarily about horror movies. So, and I give out prizes usually in the form of physical media. So, let's see. What did I do last game? It was one of them was a Stephen King box set. And what was another one? It was like a collector's special edition DVD of William Friedkin's Cruising, starring Al Pacino. That's a very good movie. And I've done stuff. I've done like vinyl soundtracks. So let's see. What did I do on the vinyl soundtrack night? I did a copy of Inseminoid, which is, you know, whatever you think of Inseminoid, but I do like the soundtrack to Inseminoid. And I also did The Exorcist 2, The Heretic, and whatever you think of Exorcist 2, but I do like the soundtrack to it. It's a, you know, a classic Ennio Morricone soundtrack, and, you know, he did everything that he could to try to make that movie better than it was. But anyways, so yes, that's again, that's at Tweety's Bar. That's located at 2908 Fruth Street, F-R-U-T-H Fruth Street in Austin, Texas. That's on the first and third Tuesdays of every month, and you can find them on Instagram. They have a website, and come on down, say hello. Don't bring me your gripes or complaints, because I don't want to hear it.
It's midnight and the sunglasses twirl. My injury's a deaf plant warped in a Hollywood rockery of juice cans and hypodermic needles.
So cool. Let's get into the next movie, okay?
If the jaundice comes up, get out of the traffic.
So we're going to be talking about a 2010 documentary called I Am Secretly an Important Man. Just like me. And it is a documentary about a fella named Stephen Jesse Bernstein, who was a sort of dark, brooding poet who lurked in the underground in the 1980s and early 90s. Jesse Bernstein was sort of on the fringes of the burgeoning rock and roll scene in Seattle. His poem, Come Out Tonight, appears on Sub Pop Records compilation album called Sub Pop 200 with bands like Nirvana and Mudhoney and Soundgarden. And it's a fine album, but you know, his tracks really sticks out because everything is sort of, you know, rock bands, you know, and then there's like this weird poet guy with a really gravelly voice. You know, but and then, yeah, like I said, it's a fine album, but for my money, I think I prefer the Sub Pop 100 compilation, the compilation previous. There's no Jesse Bernstein on it, but you have, you know, tracks from bands like Naked Ray Gun and Shonen Knife and Skinny Puppy and Anderson Bruford, Wakeman and Howe, Screwdriver, Brother Lynch Hung, and Johnny Rebel. A tremendous compilation. I'm sure you're looking it up right now. But if you want a pure, unctuous slice of Jesse Bernstein, get the album called Prison, where the track No No Man, which opens the album, you'll probably recognize from the opening title card from Oliver Stone's Natural Born Killers, as well as a poem called Face, which was the first poem I've ever heard. A friend of mine told me about Stephen Jesse Bernstein. I'd never heard of him before, even though I've seen Natural Born Killers, but I never really made the connection. Buddy of mine just started kind of reciting lines from Face. And I'm like, what are you talking about? You know, there's always been something wrong with my face. He's like, yeah, man, you never heard. This is my friend who's like a Gen Xer, you know, so he's a little older than I am. So he was a little, you know, he probably seen Jesse Bernstein like a coffee house or some shit back in the day, but I never made the connection. And you hear, if you kind of look into Jesse Bernstein, you hear that British magazine, The Independent, dubbed Stephen Jesse Bernstein the quote unquote, the godfather of grunge, which, I mean, it kind of paints a picture of who he is and the era that he was doing his thing. But, I mean, the term grunge is roundly rejected by most grunge bands, you know. It's a genre term that was, you know, it was thought of as cringe, and it's like the term alternative rock, okay? But, yeah, you know, it's a moniker that kind of stuck to his history, I guess. But he was more of a thought leader, sort of, in this Seattle rock scene, a sort of an elder statesman for all of these junky rocker bands. That's what rock music needs right now. I think it needs a Stephen Jesse Bernstein. It needs intravenous drug using alcoholics with long hair. That's what it needs. It doesn't need, you know, TikTokers smoking vape pens. You know, that's not what rock and roll needs at the moment. But I digress. As with any great documentary, I am secretly a very important man. Is chock full of well-edited, archived footage and interviews with friends and family who have stories that really help us, the audience, flesh out who this guy was. Who was he behind closed doors? Who was he in private moments? It adds to the lore of this tortured soul of a guy. And according to Jesse Bernstein's son, Damon Bernstein, on his website, here's a quote from the website. Quote, on 22 October 1991, he took a knife and stabbed himself 3 times in the neck, cutting the artery, committing suicide at the age of 40, about a month and a half before his 41st birthday, which would have been on December 4th. End of quote. So yes, Stephen Jesse Bernstein committed suicide in a friend's home with a knife. But don't feel like that's like a big spoiler or anything. I definitely say check out the documentary. It's very good. If you can get a hold of Prison, the album, do so. I have a physical, I have a CD of it, actually. I listen to it in my car on the regular. And it's great. It's great for just driving around. And every time I listen to it, I feel like I hear something that I didn't hear before. And what else do I listen to in my car? Let's just touch on that for a moment. What do I listen to in my car? Well, I drive a vehicle. I'm not going to get into exactly what kind of vehicle I have, but it does have a CD player. Okay, it's a very high-performance machine. Okay, but I yearn for the physical media of my youth. So I make sure there's a functional CD player in my vehicle. And I have Stephen Jesse Bernstein's Prison album. I have Sisters of Mercy, The Floodland, The Holy Mountain by Sleep. What else is in there? I think I have The Emperors and the Nightside Eclipse and something else. But yeah, that's what I'm listening to when I'm driving around. When I want to like just kind of listen to music. But other than that, I'm listening to conservative talk radio. 99.7. Actually, Austin has really good radio. It's got really good sort of local music radio shows. And it's got kind of everything. It's got everything you would want in a local radio market. It's actually pretty decent. And when I moved out here, I never thought I'd be like driving around listening to the radio. But it's actually pretty good. Jesse Bernstein, you know, he did do some acting. He didn't do much acting, but one film is called Shredder Orpheus. Shredder Orpheus is basically the story of Orpheus and Eurydice, the Greek tragedy, but it's in a sort of modern retelling. But modern in like the late 80s type of kind of retelling. Oh my God, it might have been the early 90s. But basically, Stephen Jesse Bernstein plays a friend of Orpheus named Axel. So he's a side character. He's not like the main character. And I mean, Greek tragedies are fine, I guess. And I wanted to really like Shredder Orpheus, and I dig the sort of shoestring budget. It is a very low budget movie, and I dig the 80s aesthetic and visually. I like it, but if you're like me and don't keep up with, you know, Greek tragedies, the movie is kind of confusing and weird. I would say if you want to watch Shredder Orpheus and you can see Jesse Bernstein in that, I'd recommend watching a late 80s TV show called Jim Henson's Storytellers. There's an Orpheus and Eurydice episode, and it was sort of like later kind of Jim Henson when he was like, not everything looked like a fucking Sesame Street sock puppet, like the, you know, that era of like the Dark Crystal, okay? Like the puppets had real interesting articulation, and he was making bigger, more interesting creatures. And in Jim Henson's Storytellers, the Orpheus and Eurydice episode, I mean, it's got real actors, and it's got all the charming Jim Henson puppet characters that blend in really nicely with the story, and it's interesting. You can find it. I'm sure you can find old copies of it somewhere, or it's probably on YouTube or archive.org. But yeah, check out Jim Henson's Storytellers, and it's just very well done show, and it's just one of those shows you just don't see that level of quality anymore, because it's just like it's like they get these excellent like British actors to act next to, like, okay, so the guy who's like the quote unquote storyteller of the story, there's like a narrator, like in the if you watch the Orpheus Eurydice Jim Henson Storytellers episode, you know, it's like a Greek tragedy, right? So the narrator's like in a toga, so he's in like period correct clothing, and his companion, his little friend, is a dog, but the dog is a Muppet dog, so it looks like a dog, but you can kind of tell it's not a dog when he's talking to it. He's like, "Hey, buddy, how's it going?" And the dog's just like, "Rrr." You can tell it's a puppet, but just the interactions with real actors and these really sort of kind of technical marvels of puppetry is really a joy to watch. But getting back to Shredder Orpheus, go watch that episode of Jim Henson's Storytellers, and then go back and watch Shredder Orpheus. Then it's a little bit more enjoyable once you kind of understand the story, if you don't already know it already. But, you know, Jesse Bernstein was a side character in that movie anyway. So, you know, I mean, he was a side character at best. You know, it's like the story's not even about him at all. But I'm going to cut it off right there. So go check out the following films: Amazon Women on the Moon, and the documentary I Am Secretly a Very Important Man. And if you have time, go watch Shredder Orpheus as well. Well, that concludes Season 2, Episode 1. Pretty good, huh? You can find me on Instagram at skeleton_factory. You can watch video Skeleton Factory episodes at patreon.com/Skeleton Factory. And I'm also on Twitter at SF Podcast ATX. Other than that, thank you very much for listening. And should have a new episode up very, very soon. So stay tuned to that. Well, this is the Skeleton Factory podcast, rescuing your movie night, one movie at a time. I am Adam. I'll catch you on the next one. Bye-bye. Bye-bye.